Hello, my name is Nicholas Ward, and this is Historical Hysteria. Today we are talking about Hollywood and five ways early Hollywood was horrific. Starting with number five, Asbestos Snow. That title's pretty self-explanatory. You know how fake snow in movies never looks quite right, but then you put on an old movie like A Christmas Story or The Wizard of Oz, and you watch those huge clumps of beautiful snow drifting lazily in the air, transporting you to a winter wonderland. Yeah, they don't use that anymore because it was asbestos. Asbestos, if you aren't familiar, is an incredibly dangerous mineral that used to be used in various household applications like insulation and fire protection. It is also unbelievably carcinogenic. Movies like The Wizard of Oz, It's a Wonderful Life, and Citizen Kane use this stuff. Eventually, the company that manufactured it, Ray Bestos, ironically, they made it as a safe alternative to the old cotton snow. They went bankrupt from a mountain of lawsuits. But let's move on to number four, piles and piles of dead animals. In 1903, Thomas Edison was trying to prove his direct current electricity was superior to Tesla's alternating current. The only problem was, it wasn't. So, what did Edison do? Well, Topsy the Elephant was a Coney Island attraction who was sentenced to death after trampling a few circus goers. Topsy was sentenced to hang, but Edison had an idea. He convinced New York to let him electrocute the elephant using Tesla's AC electricity. Edison filmed the event and published the short film Electrocuting an Elephant. Then the stunt failed, and we still use AC today, because it's way better. But back to poor old Topsy. Well, despite how weird and awful this was, Topsy got lucky in some respects. Topsy died quickly. For a lot of animals in Hollywood, this just wasn't the case. Early Hollywood was built on piles and piles of their poor, horribly mangled corpses. During the Western boom, the horse shot out from under the protagonist trope was often accomplished with a wire loop around the horse's leg. That was then ripped back to cause the horse to fall over. Sometimes they did this at full gallop. And if you're wondering what this did to the horse, well, the 1936 film The Charge of the Light Brigade, 25 horses were so severely injured they had to be put down. Horses had it pretty rough pre-CGI. In the 1947 film Cheyenne, a runaway horse was supposed to collide with the protagonist, but when the scene looked a little bit fake because the stunt horse wouldn't actually collide with the actor, they compromised by setting a real fire to panic the horse, then just filming a now actually runaway horse nearly killing a stuntman. But that was the 40s. Did we even understand things like basic human decency then? Well, things started to get a bit better after the 60s as groups like the Humane Society lobbied for better protections of animals in the movies. At least they did in America. In 1986, the film The Adventures of Milo and Otis came out. It was a heartwarming film where a cat and a pug journey back home through a perilous world, having death-defying adventures, fighting bears and going over waterfalls. The filmmakers got around the terrible 80s CGI by using the groundbreaking practical effect of pushing a kitten off a waterfall and throwing an actual pug at an actual baby bear. Now, how many kittens and pugs died during the film is something of an urban legend. People often say 20, but there's no real proof of this. But if you want to have a very unpleasant evening, you can watch a video of a very real pug being thrown at a very real bear and a very distressed kitten going over a real waterfall. Or if you're broken and watch through the end, you can watch a very real cat being thrown off a very real cliff into a very real sea and looking absolutely panicked during the entire affair. Anyway, moving on to number three, poison paint and no job security. During the filming of the 1939 Wizard of Oz, Dorothy, the Cowardly Lion, the Scarecrow, and the Tin Man tried to find what they each wanted. The Lion wanted courage, the Scarecrow a brain, and the Tin Man needed urgent medical care and workers' comp. Unfortunately, he would get neither. If you're struggling to remember that part, it's because the original Tin Man, Buddy Ebsen, never made it into the movie. Ebsen had traded roles from Scarecrow to Tin Man, donned his silvery paint, and 9 days into filming, almost died when his lungs collapsed. See, the makeup that was being used was extremely toxic and almost killed him. He would have recurring health problems for the rest of his life. MGM, having naturally almost killed him, fired him. His voice did remain in the movie, so he got some money, but still, not exactly ideal. Anyway, number two, stunt actors and their deaths. Hey kid, you wanna see a dead body? You wanna? Well, let me introduce you to the movie Love Serenade, a 1996 Australian movie about a man who's possibly secretly a fish. Okay, this isn't Hollywood, but this amazingly weird movie culminates in a pair of sisters pushing a creepy radio DJ off a grain silo and a long uncut shot of the man falling and hitting the ground. The shot was supposed to cut away to hide the inflatable crash mats, which would catch the man. The crash mats malfunctioned, and the stuntman plummeted to his death. And the scene was left in the movie. Human death is surprisingly and disturbingly common in film, especially among stunt people. Unfortunately, corporatizing human stories has a bad habit of using and abusing people. In the early days of Hollywood, before it was a multi-billion dollar industry, stunt people would get shot at with real bullets, run over by actual runaway horses, and just poisoned. Like, constantly. Unfortunately, stunts are incredibly dangerous. Even today, with modern safety standards, people die all the time. During 1986's Top Gun, pilot Art Shawl crashed and died performing an aerial role. During the 1994 filming of The Crow, Brandon Lee was shot after props kept switching between blanks and real bullets. And in 1981, Paolo Rigoni was trapped under a bobsled and dragged to death. So on top of a mountain of animal corpses is a similar, slightly smaller pile of human corpses. If you're wondering why stunt acting is so dangerous, well, when 21st Century Fox was found liable for the death of Joy Harris on the set of Deadpool 2, they were fined the princely sum of $300,000. Deadpool made $785 million. So I'm sure the studios definitely learned their lessons. On an aside, this is a personal anecdote, and I just want to stress I haven't been able to find any proof of this, but an old director did once tell me that there was an unofficial rule in films that when a stunt person died, their death scene would be left in the movie as sort of an homage to their work. And this was something that stunt people and films agreed on. But again, I've never found any proof of that, just what an old director told me. But that brings us on to number one, the drugging of children. Exploitation of children in Hollywood is like America and Red, White, and Blue. They just belong together. Children have been subjected to everything from wage theft to 80-hour work weeks. But surely no one is evil enough to straight up drug children. Well, Julie Garland said otherwise. The post-war superstar, who began her career in 1939 as Dorothy the Witch-Slaying Girl from Kansas, says she was given amphetamines to get her through 12-hour working days. But when not getting drugged to get through the day, child actors were rampantly exploited by just everyone since day one. In the 1930s, Jackie Coogan made over $4 million through his movies, only to find as an adult his mother had spent it all. He sued and got back a little under $200,000. Definitely worth not getting a real childhood. Coogan got a law named after him which protected child workers' hard-earned profits, so long as they were in a trust, earned in entertainment, and only about 15% of your profits were actually protected. You know, I could have sworn child labour was one of those things we just all agreed was kind of wrong. Thankfully, over the years, working with children has come under strict welfare checks and restrictions on working hours. But it's still work. And especially in films where a child is, say, a protagonist, like Harry Potter, it's taking a child and making them the linchpin of a multi-million and sometimes multi-billion dollar business. The 2001 Harry Potter movie took three 11-year-olds and put them at the center of a franchise that made nearly $8 billion. Unlike an adult, a child can't be held to a long-term contract, and they have strict protections on working today. But when you take a child and you make them central to a multi-million dollar film and hundreds of jobs, there is suddenly a lot of pressure from a lot of angles to keep that child working, regardless of what is good for that child. And regardless of what worker protections you put in place, there is inherently going to be a lot of money and power interested in exploiting and controlling that child. It's almost like child acting should be illegal. Sorry, those are my filthy commie sympathies coming through. What's that? Communists had child labour. Well, whatever, that's some sort of sympathies coming through. Unfortunately, literally dozens of child stars, from the Goonies' Corey Feldman to Matilda's Mara Wilson, have talked about the pressures, abuses, and exploitations of power children in film are subjected to constantly. According to Hollywood insiders, it's created an industry of creepy child fixers whose sole job is to never say no to children, to keep them addicted to being on set, through whatever means necessary, including drugs. But anyway, I'm sure that doesn't happen anymore. After all, Harvey Weinstein, he got what was coming to him. So did Bill Cosby. Admittedly, slightly less than you might have wanted, but still, there was some justice. So clearly, people are standing up and putting the predators in their place. In 2003, Quentin Tarantino, one of the biggest and most marketable directors in the world, currently summed up Hollywood's respect for children by saying, quote, "That's not rape, that's statutory rape. She wanted it." While referring to child rapist Roman Polanski and the 13-year-old that he raped. Wait, well, it's a bad example, isn't it? Damn it, why didn't I find a better example? Do we have any clips of how great child actors are treated now? No? Okay then, maybe child labor should be illegal even if you point a camera at it. Anyway, that is all the time we have for today. Thank you for joining me. Feedback can be sent to historicalhysteria@gmail.com, and don't forget to check out the socials, r/historicalhysteria on Reddit and at Manic History on Twitter. But before I leave, let me leave you with this. In the early 20th century, Australia had one of the largest film industries in the world. The government of the new country tried desperately to attract international filmmakers and sponsored movies left, right and centre. The first feature-length film in history was made in Australia. Unfortunately, distances and competition eventually killed Australian competitiveness, but Australia produced over 150 films in the 1910s. As a groundbreaking nation of filmmakers, what did Australia do with its old priceless films? Well, they were loaded onto boats, buildings and onto film sets to be burned. Yep, just burned. The highly flammable nitrate film looks great on screen when on fire. Were the films archived? No. Australia has a history of producing quality films and then not caring a damn about archiving them. The 1971 film Wake in Fright is often credited both locally and internationally as the greatest Australian movie ever made, and was lost for decades after release until the director managed to track down enough damaged versions of the film to stitch together a complete copy. Anyway, bye.